You're listening to the Sportsman's Nation Podcast Network, brought to you by Lacrosse Boots. If you guys haven't checked out the new Navigator series from Lacrosse, I strongly suggest you do that. Two really good boots within that Navigator series, the Windrose and the Atlas. If you want to find out more information about all of the boots that Lacrosse offers, visit their website, lacrossefootwear.com. You won't regret it.
Welcome to the Transition Wild podcast, brought to you by Expedition Archery. I'm your host, Adam Parr, and you're listening to episode number 61, where we talk grizzly bear encounters with Mike Mershon. Hello, and thanks again for tuning into the Transition Wild podcast, the number one source for Western big game hunting. I can't believe we're already in February. This is just getting nuts. The year 2020 is flying by, and as we're getting closer, I know it's February. I used to look at, I don't know, when I was younger and just hunting in Michigan for whitetails, and the season opened October 1st, man, hunting, although I thought about it a lot, I didn't really start preparing and thinking about it till like really the summer, because I didn't really need to. There's just a lot less going on, a lot less gear, a lot less preparation, a lot less land and species to deal with. But now that I've lived in the West, man, it just seems like, wow, you get done with archery hunting in September and holy cow, next thing you know, it's February, March, and it's starting to get warm out, and you really got to get your stuff together because you got to start applying for tags and figuring out what you got to do and where you're going to go. And it's just, I already feel like I'm behind the game. I don't know if you guys are in the same boat as me, but it just seems like it never stops or slows down, which is fine, you know, I roll with it, but it's going to come quick. And for 2020, I'm really leaning heavily towards a high country mule deer hunt here in Colorado. I think I want to, spend some points and, you know, see what I can get into for a couple points and see what I can get into for a high country mule deer hunt. I think that'll be really cool with the bow in hand. So that's what I'm thinking about, and we'll see what comes for elk after that. But whatever happens, it'll be a fun year. And if you guys are planning on hunting in Colorado in 2020, I've yet to release it yet, but I'm working on the 2020 version of the Colorado Beginner Elk Hunting Guide. And that's a free PDF download. If you go to my site, you subscribe, basically give me your email, and I will send you the Colorado Beginner Elk Hunting Guide for free. And that just walks you through getting started here in Colorado with elk, everything you need to know from scouting to gear to preparation to various resources and tons of articles and podcasts that you can listen to that really get you jacked up and, you know, provide a lot of information for this fall. So definitely go subscribe, transitionwild.com. I'll send you the Colorado Beginner Elk Hunting Guide for free. And once you're on that list, when I upgrade to the 2020 version, I will, I'll send that out to you as well. So stay tuned for that. Thanks for everybody who's subscribed, left reviews. Those 5-star reviews mean a lot. Keep those coming. Much, much appreciated. All right, my guest today, Michael Mershon. He's a resident of Montana, and this is a podcast I've really wanted to record for some time now. I've always kind of been infatuated with hunting elk or deer or whatever, but it seems like elk more in grizzly country. And I'm just real interested from a couple standpoints of, you know, eventually hunting in Idaho or Montana or some of these states outside of Colorado that have grizzly bears. And then also just wanted to hear about the, you know, what Mike has a really interesting story. He's lived and hunted in grizzly bear country, and he's got a pretty close call encounter from this past fall. So I really wanted to hear the story on that and hear that firsthand. So it was really cool talking with him. I learned a lot. Great story, great guy. So let's not wait any longer. Let's get Mike Mershon on the line. Before we begin, today's episode is brought to you by Expedition Archery, manufacturer of the world's finest archery experience. Expedition bows combine aerospace level quality, innovative designs, and a fluid feel serious hunters demand. Test drive one today at your nearest archery retailer and view their full lineup at expeditionarchery.com. Why settle for status quo when opportunity and adventure awaits? Make your next hunt an expedition. All right, on the line with us now, Mike Mershon from Montana. How are you, Mike?
Doing good, yeah.
Yeah, sounds like you've been on the mountain for the last day or so. You guys just got hit with a bit of snow, so you've been doing some skiing and in the mountains. Sounds like that's been fun. How was that?
Yeah, absolutely. We finally got our good late winter storm hit us and snuck out for a quick Monday day of powder. So yeah, it worked out well.
That's a good way to spend the day after the Super Bowl is getting a little bit of time on the mountain and skiing. I'm sure that's a lot better than working.
Yeah, that's right. They say that that Monday after the Super Bowl is the most called in day for work, right? So I figured that was a good enough excuse.
That makes sense. Yeah, yeah. If you're not calling in, you're either going to be super unproductive. It should just be a national holiday for a lot of people, and because most people are probably hungover or can't really concentrate too well.
Yeah, well, if it wasn't for a powder snow, I'd probably be back at work.
Got it. What do you do for work?
Oh, I'm a contractor here in Billings, Montana. Do some management for some rental properties and stuff like that. Self-employed.
Okay.
Very cool.
Does that give you a little bit more flexibility for hunting and doing some of the outside activities?
Yeah, you hit it right on the nail head there. That's the principal reason behind my motivations. I'm fortunate enough to be able to structure my work schedule to take off an extended amount of time throughout the fall.
Yeah, 100%. That's one of the perks of doing your own thing. That's great. That's really cool. And so you said you're from Billings, Montana, or that's where you currently live. Did you grow up there? Or are you a Montana resident, Montana native?
Well, yeah. So I was born in Colorado, lived at St. Mary's Glacier, just above Idaho Springs there.
Oh, wow.
And so that's kind of over in your neck of the woods, I think. And then, we moved up to Montana in 91. So I've been in Montana, all my adult life. And that's where, my hunting career and outdoor career has really blossomed.
Yeah, I was going to say, Montana's probably a whole different – Colorado's wild, and there's a lot of public land, but I've heard Montana is just a whole other realm of that, less people, I guess, and more wild places.
Sure, yeah. I mean, I still love Colorado. I still go back there, and I've got family back there a little bit still. And so, the sights can't be beat in Colorado, but I call Montana home now, and I'm pretty happy with the little nooks and crannies that I found up here.
Yeah, 100%. So did you grow up like that? Did your dad and or family kind of get you into hunting, or is that something you kind of picked up on your own?
When we moved to Montana, we moved here because we had a lot of family up here already. And so really it was my uncle and grandfather who got me into hunting. My father certainly introduced me to the outdoors and gave me appreciation for the outdoors, but he was never really a hunter himself. And so my hunting background really came from my uncle and, of course, my grandfather as well.
Yeah, 100%. That's really cool. Yeah, I've had a few guys on the podcast that got into hunting late in life, and that's been a really cool perspective too. But, for myself, and it sounds like you just kind of grew up with it in the family. It's just kind of in your blood, and it's what you've always known, and you've carried it on to your later years.
Yep, absolutely. I was fortunate enough to I couldn't wait till the first year that I could go to elk camp with the guys, back then, grandpa and uncle Rick and everybody, they would do a big, trip there at the end of the season, and they'd pull in, set, you know, the big huge tent with big huge camp with wall tents and horse trailers and the whole nine yards. And those first couple of years, I was able to go in and tag along with Gramps and ride horses with him and got to experience that early on. And then, you know, as I kind of got old enough to really hunt, all those guys were kind of ending their career. And so they sold off all the horses and everything. And you know, by the time I was really up and going gung-ho, you know, those guys were more or less retired and kind of hanging out at camp more than hunting.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, you know, it's kind of a lost way of hunting or style of hunting. I mean, some people still do it, but usually it's with an outfitter or, you know, a guide service. There's less of the DIYers setting up wall tents and doing the horses and all that stuff. It just seems like that was kind of more of an older generation thing, and it's still certainly going on. But I feel like just the costs and a lot of new technologies, it's kind of, you know, something that's a smaller piece of elk hunting now.
Yeah, sure. I think you kind of hit it on the nail. It's just so expensive for the average guy to manage that anymore. You know, keeping horses around for the whole year just to hunt off of them. You know, you're feeding those animals the whole time and vet bills and everything. So, you know, I certainly know guys that still keep stock around and guys that hunt off mules and stuff like that. But yeah, I personally can't afford to, you know, keep stock around though. So as I'm starting to get older, it's like, oh, I see exactly why those guys did that.
Oh yeah. Yeah. No.
As the extractions get harder, it really, really makes the guy ponder how you could pull that off having some llamas or goats or something.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. So are elk, is that kind of your main gig, what you love the most, or do you do mule deer, antelope, any other species, or do you just love elk?
Yeah, the whole nine yards. I'm pretty wide open to the species. I certainly concentrate on elk, mule deer. I'm kind of addicted to big mule deer right now for the last couple of years. You know, mostly big game. I do a little bit of bird hunting, but I can kind of save them out for my retirement plan, you know.
Yeah, a little gentler, more action, you know, it can take more breaks. It's not as hardcore.
Exactly.
That's fun hunting there. Yeah, for sure.
Bird hunting and fly fishing, that's my retirement plan.
There you go. Pound the mountain now and get into those nasty, gnarly spots way back in while you can, because those years are limited.
Yeah, that's for sure.
So is majority of your hunting done in Montana, or do you hit any other maybe neighboring states, Idaho, or do you get back down here to Colorado? What does your typical fall look like?
Yeah, so I've always, you know, like I said, I'm just a average working guy. So I've always just concentrated on residency here in Montana, you know. I stay busy between elk and a deer tag and an antelope tag starting in August, you know, that keeps the guy busy all the way through fall.
Oh yeah.
Although just recently I have been kind of looking at, you know, some of the other funner hunts, like, you know, these deer hunts that are in January down in Arizona and stuff like that. I don't know that I'd really be too interested in going out of state to chase elk in September when, you know, we have such prime hunting right here out of my back door.
Yeah, exactly. It's like my buddy Dan Johnson, who does the Nine Finger Chronicles podcast, and, you know, he does the Sportsman's Nation podcast network where this show is hosted. But, you know, he lives in Iowa, so it's like, why would he go anywhere else to hunt whitetails in any other state? You know, I mean, he comes out and hunts elk with me, but he has no reason to leave to go anywhere else for Iowa. And I was like, yeah, I understand, I get it, man, it makes total sense. Why leave something you know, and it's some of the best in the world? So
yeah, exactly. I always tell people I hunt places that I want to be in, you know. So sometimes guys laugh at the areas that I hunt, but it's like I hunt those areas because I enjoy being in those areas. I don't necessarily want to go tromping all around just to see new areas. I like being in the areas that I know.
Okay, got it. Yeah, I was gonna have you clarify that. So you like going learning the spots over the years, dialing those in, and then really, you know, learning it so you have some good success and know what you're getting into.
Sure, yeah. And, you know, we certainly hunt a large section of the state, and I've actually kind of made it a point, like in my own mind, to expand my horizons, because there for a few years I was getting to the point where it's like I would just go from the, you know, the same saddle, same knoll, look at the same stuff, and we'd always kill elk doing that. But it's like, you know, I want to go, you know, let's go see what's around us, you know?
Yeah.
So, yeah. I mean, I have kind of made it a point to expand my horizons, but, you know, there's enough stuff around us that it'll keep a guy busy for multiple lifetimes.
Yeah, for sure. Well, that paints a pretty good picture of your background, Mike, and, you know, your hunting style and kind of what you're after. And as you know, I wanted to have you on the podcast to talk about hunting elk and grizzly bear country, and then also talk about, you know, an encounter that you've had this past fall, which is, it's really interesting. I can't wait to hear the story, but, you know, obviously I sent out a little post on Rock Slide and we kind of started the conversation there, and you told me a little bit about it. And, you know, I just really want to dive into that and hear it, because from myself, it's kind of a two-part thing for the podcast. One, I think it's a good story and very interesting, but at the same time, I also want to hunt in a state of Montana or Idaho, or because in Colorado we don't have that dynamic here with something that can really you up. So I'm sure it adds a whole nother element. So I kind of want to start with, like, you know, talking about grizzly country in general. I don't want to get into the story just yet, but talking about hunting in grizzly country, and you know, is this something, have you always hunted in areas, obviously there's different parts of the state where, you know, there's higher populations and, you know, lower densities in certain units, but have you always kind of found yourself hunting in and around grizzly country?
Yeah, for the most part, like I said, you know, I learned a lot of my hunting from, you know, from grandparents and uncle and everybody. And I like to hunt in the mountains. And so that by itself has led me to always hunt in grizzly country, you know. And so we've always hunted, and we hunt, you know, mountain ranges and areas that are well known for their bear densities. And, you know, it's kind of just the country that I've grown up in, whether it's, you know, backpacking in the summer or skiing in the winter or hunting in the fall. You know, those are kind of the areas I enjoy being in. So, yeah, I do hunt those areas. And, you know, throughout the years, I mean, you guys see in the news articles as well, there's like every year there's bear encounters. And, you know, we've had guys in our camp, get attacked and have encounters and stuff. And so, you know, in your mind, you're always aware that they're out there and you're seeing them and you're seeing their tracks and everything. But, you know, it's a choice. You can either go out there and hunt and enjoy yourself, or, you know, you can be intimidated and not enjoy yourself.
Yeah.
But, you know, you just kind of have to choose to be aware of what's going on around you and go out and enjoy yourself still.
Yeah, for sure. You know, like, for myself, it's very hard to imagine the perspective or what I would feel like, you know, if you place me in Montana and I'm in an area of high grizzly population, I would, as somebody who's not used to that, I feel like my senses would be really heightened and I would be, you know, probably scared in some scenarios or but to you, is it kind of more second nature? Like, obviously you're aware and you've prepared and, you know, you take necessary precautions, mm-hmm. but is it kind of more second nature at this point?
Yeah, I think it is. Like I said, the majority of my recreating is in these mountains. And so it's just a part of the way I recreate. You know, if we're out trail running in the summertime, then, you know, we're making noise and hooping and hollering and have dogs with us and stuff. And, you know, in the fall, you're kind of, like you say, your senses are heightened. You need to be aware of what's going on around you. And, you know, as my story will tell, sometimes even that doesn't account for it. But, you know, you just, yeah, it's second nature to go out into the mountains and just know that you're sharing those hills with an apex predator, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. Would you say that since you started hunting maybe in the mid 90s or whenever that was, are you seeing more grizzly bears? Are you seeing, maybe not necessarily like face-to-face encounters, but are you just seeing more and seeing more sign and, tell us a little bit about
that. Yeah, glassing and stuff. It sure seems that way. Whether or not we actually are, I mean, I've got to assume that we are, because we know that the populations are increasing. And so, you know, it definitely seems like we are. We've always seen bears, you know, here and there, and we've always come across tracks and stuff like that. But, man, it sure seems like we're seeing an increase in numbers. This area that I was in, I was scouting it last summer, the summer leading up to a season. And I was up at the head of a great glassing vantage, so I could see down into three separate big drainages. You know, I could see like 2 miles every direction. And I went up there just a quick overnight trip and came back out like midday the next day. And I think I counted 13 bears and 11 of them were grizzlies.
Wow.
So like that was the day that I've seen the most bears.
Yeah.
And that
yeah.
was, you know, last year.
Yeah. Wow.
So
that's
sure
crazy.
Seems like we're seeing more.
Yeah. 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 It makes a whole lot of sense. I was just curious, you know, from somebody who's kind of seen the trend, you know, from 20 some years ago to now, it's, you know, it's interesting to hear you, you know, say that and you're seeing them. It's not necessarily anecdotal evidence. I mean, it's something that you're experiencing firsthand. So
yeah.
Interesting.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
What are you doing from a gear perspective as far as, you know, preparing or, you know, like, I guess let's talk about, you know, a handgun or a sidearm and bear spray. Mm-hmm. Like what are you doing? I guess what caliber are you using and what are kind of some of the things that you're doing with your gear setup in order to protect against a potential encounter?
Sure. Yeah. So I'm kind of a gear nut, you know, like most of us are. So I'm always playing and tinkering with my setups and you know, doing mods and trying to change things incrementally. But I've always carried bear spray. That's just a constant. Anytime I'm in the mountains, I have bear spray on me. You know, if I'm trail running or anything, bear spray is always on me. And then there for a while, I started carrying a great big Ruger Alaskan, you know, a 454
wow.
Revolver. And I carried that in a leather chest holster and you know, it was a quality holster. It was super nice leather work and everything, but it had a thumb snap over it. And so the draw sequence was, you know, slightly slower than normal, than an open top holster would be. And then, of course, like most hunters nowadays, I also wear a bino harness. And so it was kind of just a cluster having that holster kind of buried in with your binos, you know?
Yeah, sure.
Like you could get set up to where you could access it, but it was just never quite ideal. So there for, you know, there for a while, I tried making that work, and then I just abandoned the pistol altogether and just went back to carrying bear spray. And then I, went through and kind of reevaluated things, and I took a really great course out of Bozeman through Tactic Montana was the outfit's name, and they kind of showed me some stuff that interested me, and there's another guy out of Bozeman making holsters that hang underneath your vinyl harness, and so I wound up making one similar to his for the gun that I had, which was a Kimber 357, just a small lightweight revolver. And that's kind of why I've switched to. It's a Kydex holster, so you know, it just more or less clips into place.
Yep.
The revolver into the holster. There's no physical containment straps or anything to it. And so your draw sequence is extremely quick, easy to access. You know, when you're taking layers on and off all the time, it's just one vinyl harness instead of a vinyl harness and a holster.
Got
to,
it.
You know, drop a layer. And so I just found myself carrying that way more often, which, you know, if you're going to carry a gun, then carry it all the time.
Yeah, yeah, and have it, you know, at the ready and where you can get to it as quick as possible and, you know, what's most comfortable for you, I'm sure. So,
yeah, yep, exactly.
Now,
and
oh, yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, so that's kind of been my progression. And then, that's what I used this past fall was that 357 on my chest. And I'm still kind of playing with things, and just me as, you know, as I know myself, I know that I shoot semi-automatic, guns, pistols more efficiently and more often than I do my revolvers.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
I think my next thing that I'm looking into is, you know, a 10 millimeter worn on my hip. Again, just because that's kind of my most go-to sequence. That's very familiar to me. I can point those guns the same across all the guns that I carry. And I'm just trying to simplify things as to be more efficient.
Yeah, yeah, 100%. Now, if I was hunting regularly in grizzly country, I think I would be at the range a lot more often practicing, or at least, you know, shooting my handgun and practice drawing. Is that something that, you know, you keep on top of and you're shooting your gun quite a bit and practicing your draw sequence and kind of going through the motions there?
Yeah, absolutely. I think that's the most important thing, whatever weapon or, you know, method of defense you choose. If you're going to use bear spray, that still needs to be practiced with.
Yeah.
I would strongly encourage anybody who carries bear spray to either buy a bottle of practice spray, and you know, that it's an inert spray, but it still acts the same.
Yeah.
Or just go shoot off one of your out of date canisters. I'm sure everybody has. Make sure it's going downwind, and you know, take the proper precautions and everything. But yeah, absolutely. You need to practice with my revolvers and pistols and everything. You'll kind of notice I started with a big boomer and have incrementally stepped my way down in caliber and cartridge size. And, you know, if you don't shoot a lot, those big hand cannons are a son of a gun to hang on to and get repeatable hits on, you know? And, so that's what I would say in a nutshell.
Where do you carry your bear spray at?
Everything.
Is your bear spray on your other hip, or where do you carry that at?
Yeah, so I've got it configured so that my pistols are configured for my strong hand draw, you know, so I can access it with a single hand. And then I set up my bear spray on my left hip to access with my weak hand draw. So if both hands are accessible, it's very doable to draw both of those at the same time and hold your bear spray with your pistol, with both hands on your pistol, so that you can have both up and accessible at the same time. Or in the case of, archery hunters, we almost always have our bow in our hands when we're hunting, right?
Yeah.
And most of us right-handers have our bow in our left hand. So we're going to be probably drawing with a single hand at that point.
Yeah.
And, if you're whatever pinned to your right or whatever, you have a weapon on either side of you, or, a method of defense on either side of you potentially.
That makes sense. Now, when, let's say you're having an afternoon lunch break, or you're dipping water out of a stream, is that gun and bear spray, is that on you at all times, or are you kind of loose with, oh, maybe it's right there at the backpack and I can get to it?
Yeah, so like I said, I carried with a chest holster for a while, and so that was on me all the time. And then I carried, currently with a holster on my bino harness, and yeah, that's on me all the time. The only time I take that off is, basically crawling into the sleeping bag or whatever into the tent, and then that gun's, set up in the corner
right there at the ready.
Or wherever. Yeah, right there at the ready. At least accessible. So I mentioned earlier that I'm now kind of looking at doing a hip holster. And the reason for that is I found when I'm working on, when I'm processing an animal in the field, previously, I always liked taking, my bino harness off, just because you're always bent down and working and stuff. And this last couple of years, I've been leaving that on because that's where my pistol's at. And so that's kind of a pain, when you're bent down, having to deal with all that hanging there in front of you. Well, that's kind of plays into me wanting to play with having a hip holster. So, like I said, I'll play that out this year and see if it balances out, or maybe I'll wind up going back to a chest holster.
Got it. Now, it talked a little bit about being around camp too. Let's talk about when you do an overnight, or let's say an extended hunt where you're setting up a camp. What are some precautions that you are doing when you set that up? Obviously, food is away, and probably hung in a tree. Do you do anything like security measures for alerting anything coming into camp? Tell us a little bit about that setup.
Yeah, so my setups, I see it as, just everyday camp, but I'm sure, like you say, some guys don't think of this stuff. And so I kind of had to think about it for a second of what exactly it is that I do. And all of this stuff, talking guns and talking weapons and stuff like that, sure, it's fun and makes us feel warm and fuzzy inside, but all this other stuff is really what keeps us safe, I feel like.
Yeah.
And so, at camp, there's, and this is all stuff that a guy can get off of like the National Forest Service websites and stuff like that. Setting up your cooking area and your sleeping area and your bear hang, making that all far enough away from each other to not, have a bear wander through the whole dang thing. And so I think there's supposed to be like 100 yards or something between where you hang your food and where you cook. And usually the way that plays out for me is, you know, if I'm going into an area, I'm going into an area to set up my camp, and then I'm going to go glass. And so I'll generally go to my glassing knob first and drop all of my like all my cooking stuff and everything out there, and then I'll keep going, and you know, go however far it is, at least 100 yards, but you know, I might even go another half a mile or something and go set up my camp there. And that's going to only be, you know, my sleeping stuff. And that's pretty much it. My sleeping stuff.
Yeah.
You know, so I'll set up my bivy sack or my tarp or my tent or whatever it is. And then I'll turn around and come back to all my food, all my cook stuff. All that stuff will never even come into my sleeping area. And so then, you know, I'll spend all day or whatever glassing, and that's where I'll make my meals and eat and do everything else. And then at night, my, you know, I'll find a tree somewhere in between there, or hang it off of a cliff or something like that. You know, in between those two areas where, you know, it'll be separated. And so I try not to ever bring any of my food stuff into my camp.
Yeah. Yeah. Makes sense.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's, yeah. You know, and for me hunting in Colorado, I guess I'm just never really worried about it. Obviously there's black bears, but I mean, I guess I should probably take more precautions, but I constantly have food around my tent, and you know, I just leave it in my backpack.
Sure.
It's just, I mean, it's just, I've never had the threat. That's probably stupid, but you know, it's not the same level as what you're dealing with. So,
yeah, it's just not on your mind. Yeah. Yeah,
exactly. Now, talk to us about just general hunting. I mean, my buddy Chris Nolan, he works for Mystery Ranch backpacks in Montana, and he's a good close friend of mine, and I was actually just talking with him recently while we were at the ATA show in Indianapolis, and I was asking him about, you know, like, well, what are you doing during the day as far as like maybe precautions or whatever to avoid potential grizzlies? And he said, you know, he avoids certain areas. Like, I think he was saying, like, he avoids like lower, you know, brushy, thicker, like creek drainages. And he sticks more to like ridge tops during the day when they might be, you know, out and about cruising or whatever. But, I guess what's your take on that? Are you avoiding any, certain areas? Are you keying in on certain spots that maybe would, you know, be better suited to not be ambushed or caught off guard? Tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah, sure. You know, as hunters, we're doing pretty much everything that you could do wrong. You know, we're sneaking through the woods with the wind in our face, trying to move quietly, trying not to, you know, spread our senses around or anything. And so, you know, in a perfect world, do everything that you would normally not do hunting, and you would never see a bear, you know. But of course, we're out there hunting, trying to find game. So you kind of just have to be aware of that. You know, when I know that I'm hunting in a high grizzly density area, you know, my senses are certainly on point. You know, you're paying attention. It's almost like you're still hunting everywhere you go. You know, I'm sure you've still hunted into dark timber after an elk, and you know, you're paying attention to every little limb snap and everything around you.
Yeah.
And you know, that's kind of your best bet. Certainly there's things that we'll avoid, like, you know, if we know where there's a carcass, if you know, the area you're hunting is has high pressure and there's guys killing elk, if you know that somebody just killed an elk over in that drainage, then we're going to kind of give a berth around that whole area, because you know, that could very well be drawing bears into there.
Yeah.
Yeah. And then, you know, of course we're always paying attention for sign. There's plenty of times where, you know, we'll go in the morning and come back out that night, and there'll be bear tracks over our tracks. And so at that point, it's, you know, it's up to you. I mean, if there's elk in there, then, you know, maybe you're going to go back, but maybe you're not. Maybe it's time to jump over a ridge and, you know, just let that bear have that drainage. You know, the bears move so much that you're, you know, unless you're seeing them in there, it's hard to say exactly where they're at.
Yeah. Yeah, it makes sense. I know they cover miles and miles, you know, they don't stay necessarily in one spot for too crazy long, and they just do the same thing, you know, you would do if you were trying to hunt with your teeth, so.
yeah, exactly, right, you know. The other guy that we know who had an encounter, you know, he was going in the pre-dawn hours, and he was up against the trees, kind of where, you know, out in the snow to your left, it's kind of light enough to see, but off to your right in the trees, it's dark still. And he said that bear came out of that darkness. You know, we've all been there when it's just starting to get light enough where the snow is white, but the trees are just pitch black still. And so now I kind of keep that in my mind. And, you know, if I'm cruising down a trail where, you know, you have a little bit of freedom of movement and you can give yourself a little space off of that dark patch that you just can't see into, you know, that's certainly comforting to be able to step away from that edge a little bit if possible.
Yeah, that makes sense. Yeah, it's, you know, just it, like I said, it sounds like you have to kind of make a decision on what you feel comfortable with based on maybe what sign or what you've seen in the area, because like you said, it's kind of unpredictable, you know, from a lot of standpoints, and it's just, you know, using, I would think, a lot of common sense. Like you said, if there's a known grizzly in the area or there's a kill site that, you know, people have talked about or whatever, obviously you want to avoid that and at all possible, but at the same time it's a bit unpredictable, I'm sure.
Yeah, it is, and like you say, it comes down to, you know, level of risk that a guy's willing to accept. Theoretically, there could be a bear anywhere in Montana at any given point, and so, you know, if you want to go out hunting, then you have to, you know, just ask yourself, am I willing to, you know, potentially run into a bear? And I think it's pretty safe to say that those chances are slim, even for the high risk archery September elk hunters. You know, I mean, it's certainly those guys are at the highest percentage of running into a bear, but I still feel like that is a pretty slim chance.
Yeah.
You know, and especially if like you say, you're paying attention to sign and you know, if there's fresh sign in there, just back out and go somewhere else.
Yeah, 100%. Now, you said, I heard you say, you know, maybe a hunting partner or some other guys that you've shared camps with have had, you know, pretty close call grizzly encounters. Have you been directly associated with those experiences? Like, have you also had encounters with them while that happened? Or have you had other separate, maybe closer call encounters outside of this more recent one this past fall?
Yeah, so when our buddy got attacked, he actually got roughed up a little bit, and he turned that bear around with bear spray. The bear was on top of him when he sprayed him.
No kidding.
I wasn't directly with him, but I was his. I took him to the hospital. I picked him up down on the road after he hiked down to us. You know, that's certainly the worst encounter that any of my group has had. I've bumped into bears several times in the, you know, throughout my lifetime, just hiking. I had a pretty bad and pretty close encounter, several years ago coming down from a climbing trip. This was in like August or something. We were on a mountaineering trip, just a partner and I, you know, the last thing on our minds was bears or bear activity or being bear aware. And, you know, we're moving quickly and, you know, an alpine start, all this nonsense, super lightweight. And we get in there I think we're on our way back out when we looked at each other and asked each other, like, do you have bear spray? Like, no. Do you have bear spray? Neither one of us had anything.
I thought you had it. No, you had it. No.
yeah, exactly. One of those. And we knew it was meant to be because we were in a pretty remote area. And the one little spot that we happened to set up camp, we found a bottle of bear spray laying there.
Oh, yeah.
So it's like this has to be a sign. Like, we have to make sure we have this bear spray on us on our way out. And, you know, we did our little objective, and we're coming out. And, of course, the bear spray is in the bottom of my backpack.
Oh, man.
And we're like, hiking and making noise and talking and chattering. And, you know, here comes a bear, and we just came over a little rise and scared each other. And, you know, he took off running, but it was too close for comfort. He was, you know, maybe 10 yards from us or something. And it was like that incident really kind of shaped me, like, and helped me realize, like, that was the last thing that we were expecting to occur on a climbing trip. And yet, you know, we're in these same mountains. It's still the same thing as hunting, you know?
Yeah.
So just need to always be ready.
Yeah. Yeah. 100%. And the story of your buddy, I mean, actually getting, you know, mauled and roughed up a little bit. How did that go down? Do you kind of know the details of how that unfolded? I mean, obviously you don't have to drag it out, but how did that happen?
Yeah. So, you know, again, hopefully the listeners will be able to see that all of these incidents are a series of mistakes stacked on top of each other that leads up to a bad experience.
Yeah.
You know, so our little hiking, climbing experience, you know, first of all, we didn't have any bear spray with us. And then when we did have bear spray with us, it was in the bottom of the backpack, you know. And so, yeah, with my buddy's experience, again, he shot a bull right at last light. You know, he had a questionable hit on it. He went after it, pursued it for a ways, and was bumping it, I think. And so just made the decision to back out that night. You know, came back to camp. I don't remember exactly. There were several of us there, and for whatever reason, everybody split off in their own directions the next morning. You know, I think we're all in elk, and so we're all excited to go after him. But he went back in there by himself, right at first light, you know, hoping to you know, go find his bull laying in its bed. And, you know, like I said, went in the dark, and right as it was getting light, you know, just going up the trail and suddenly said, you know, one of these dark trees suddenly turned into a bear, and it was just right on top of him instantly.
Holy cow.
And this was late season with a rifle, and I think he had the rifle slung on his shoulder, and just instantly the bear kind of leapt at him, and I think he put his left arm out kind of to, you know, let it hit that first. And the bear, I think, bit onto his wrist and stuff. And so he fell backwards onto his rifle and was able to get to his bear spray on his hip. And I think the bear was standing, like, down at his feet when he sprayed it. And so he sprayed the bear spray across his body and, you know, directly into the bear. And the bear turned around and left. And he got some pretty good bites in his arm and his wrist and his hand, and then of course got bear spray all over in his face as well.
Jesus. Yeah.
He's trying to stand up and get backed away and get a shell in his gun, and trying to get snow in his face, and it was a real fiasco.
Oh, I bet.
Sounded like. Yeah. And he was able to get a single text message out to his brother, who was, you know, on another part of the mountain, and his brother was able to. It just so happened that my brother and I were the closest ones to him, and so we're all able to kind of text to each other where everybody was at, and we were able to find him down on the road. He was able to just drop straight down to us, and you know, as far as getting mauled by a bear, he had maybe the best luck a guy could have. I mean, his arm was torn up, but we got it bandaged up and took him into the hospital, and he was back to work pretty quickly. So
yeah, it sounds like it could have been
definitely
a lot worse.
It could have been a lot worse. Absolutely.
Yeah. Wow. That's crazy.
You know, so again, you know, he shot a bull that night, and then you know, went back in there by himself in the dark, and you know, again, just a kind of seems like a series of mistakes that led up to a bad encounter.
Is that something? And it sounds like your scenario was a similar deal, tracking a bull. Is that something mm-hmm. that, you know, based on this experience and maybe another one, that hey, you're tracking a maybe any sort of wounded bull that you don't find within the first, you know, couple hundred yards or whatever, would you recommend having a partner with you, or at least back up there?
I mean, certainly, I would certainly recommend it. I just happen to hunt by myself and recreate by myself a lot.
Got
so
it. Yeah, makes sense.
I'm certain, you know, I'm certainly not the model to live by, but you know, yeah, certainly having more guys, more eyes around you, you know, more help around you, it's only going to help. Yeah,
100%. So let's jump over to this past fall and let's talk about that. And it was this past September, right, in 2019, you had this encounter.
Tell us
how that unfolded and kind of, you know, what led up to it, and let's get into the nitty-gritty.
Yeah, you bet. So, this past archery elk season started on the 8th for us, and it was just a fantastic opening week. I mean, lots of encounters. The bulls were fired up. You know, just everything a guy could hope for in September. Lots of action all the way leading up to it. And I hunted with my brother for the first several days, and then he had to go back in. I stayed out, and so I, you know, get in on a herd with two bulls, and was able to you know, do some bugling and cow calling and stuff, and got this one bull to, you know, a mature 6-point bull to come in, and he turns broadside just perfectly, right where I'm wanting him to go, and I've got a nice window, you know, I don't know, a microwave sized window in the trees that he's gonna come right across through, and he's at 15 yards, and I bark at him and stop him right as he's coming up to the window, and you know, I'm drawn back, and I bark at him, and he takes one more step than I want him to. And so it registered in my brain that he was one step further than I wanted him to go. And, you know, I held the left side of the window. I thought I could still make the shot. I released the shot, you know, perfect hit, perfect pass through. He runs off, and, you know, I just sit down and give it a little bit of time. Walk over, look at my arrow, and immediately, you know, the bad shot. There's gut material on the arrow.
Ah, no.
And so, at that point, you know, it kind of starts flooding in on me. Like, you know, I registered that he took that extra step. I probably shouldn't have shot. you know, I might have had another opportunity to just let him keep going. All this stuff comes rushing in. And so, you know, I just sat down and just kind of tried to keep my calm. And I think I gave him, I don't know, I think I gave him like 4 hours or something. And, you know, the whole herd was over there. You could still hear all the cows mewing. And I didn't want to go blazing over there and push everything out of there.
Yeah.
And so I gave him, I think, 4 hours. I think I shot him at like 11 in the morning. And, you know, I just backed out and gave him as much time as I could. And then I just started kind of still hunting my way back in on him. And I got back into amongst all the cows, and they're all still right in there. And I couldn't quite pick out the bull anywhere. And I, again, just still didn't want to bump him any further. So I turned around, backed out for the night. And, you know, went back out to my camp and then got up the next morning, went back up over the pass and down into this bowl. And by then, you know, the herd had moved off and got back onto what little blood trail there was. I mean, there was just specks of blood. And so you're more or less just following elk tracks through, you know, a steep, dark forest. And so there's a lot of back and forth and just
grid searching at that point.
Trying to, well, I'm not quite grid searching yet.
Okay.
I'm still trying to follow elk tracks and like trying to track.
Got it.
And so the herd kind of funnels into a trail, and I get on the trail. I'm following the trail for, you know, maybe half a mile or something. And at that point, it's, you know, mid afternoon, and I'm starting to doubt myself and, like, you know, maybe I'm not even on his trail and all this stuff. And so I sit down and, you know, I'm eating a candy bar and, you know, kind of crinkling wrappers and kind of making a little bit of noise. And so after that, I stand up and I just start walking kind of too quickly. And over the next little rise, like 50 yards away, sure enough, I go over this little rise and bump him up out of his bed. He was laying right there. Oh, I had just eaten lunch.
Man.
And so at that point, I see him get up and turn, and, you know, there's blood down his side and just a flash of elk, and he's gone. And so, you know, at that point, I kind of tried to pursue him, and, like, instantly was just into dog hair thick timber and making too much noise. And so I backed out again. And, let me think. At that point, I had to return to work for a day. So I zipped back into town and then left again that night. I just went into the town, got my stuff taken care of, and then went right back out there that night and, you know, camped. The next morning, I get up again, go back into the same spot. And at that point, you know, I'm thinking, I'm either going to find a dead elk in here or he'll be gone. I'll never see him again. And so at that point, I pretty much, that's when I start grid searching. And I go all the way around the whole drainage and kind of glass back down into it to, you know, see if I can see birds or, you know, a bear or, you know, something to find this elk. And glass all that for most of the morning and nothing. And so I'm starting to work my way back and kind of working through it's, you know, it's a bottom. So it's good timber with patches of small openings. And so I'm kind of just still hunting my way through it. And I step out of a dark patch into, you know, maybe a 15 yard wide, opening, and there's my bull just walking away from me.
Oh God.
And, at that point I registered in my brain, like, oh, I just bumped him out of his bed and he's so sick that he can't run. He's just walking, you know? And, we've all bumped elk before and, you know, it's just a flash of yellow and branches breaking and they're gone. He's just like walking away from me. And so I'm like scrambling, like getting arrow knocked and trying to line up a shooting path through all the trees and get drawn back, release my arrow. And at that point, the bull reacts, and I thought for sure I'd hit him again. I was down, crouched in kind of an awkward position and stuff. And he reacts to the shot going off, but he's still just walking away from me slowly. And so at that point, it's like, run, there's my elk. Go get another shot. And so I break out into a run and get, maybe two strides or so. And behind me, there's suddenly just a tornado of shit breaking.
There's
branches and stuff coming down. And so, I shoot with a handheld release. So I've got my release in my right hand. My bow is in my left hand. And I turn and look back to the trees that I had just shot from. And there's the bear is coming at full tilt out of those trees, straight at me.
Holy shit.
So I just draw and shoot. It was very much just one fluid motion. I didn't recognize my sights on that first shot. And
how far away was he, do you think, when you took the first shot? Like, was he within 5 yards, 10 yards?
Yeah, so at this point, I'm thinking I have a second arrow in the bull. I thought I hit him. And so, like, after all this happens, I return to this area, thinking there's going to be still, again, a dead elk in there. And so I was able to range right directly from where I was standing to the trees. And he came out of the trees at 7 yards. And so I don't know what I shot him at. He was
very
at
close.
My feet when I
yeah.
shot.
Jeez.
Very close. Yeah. Yeah. And so, just one shot. And I think I was yelling, "Hey bear." I mean, I know I was yelling, "Hey bear." I think I got one out before the shot and then certainly after the shot. And so he's coming full bore. And I shot, and he kind of laid back onto his haunches and pivoted, 90 degrees and paralleled me for like one stride and then just went straight back into the trees where he came from.
Oh, gosh.
So I pulled out, shot, the recoil pulse happened. I acquired my sights on him, and at that point he was, exiting away from me. And from there, it sounded like the Tasmanian devil or something.
He's
growling and popping his jaws, and he went down into a big willow thicket, and it just sounded like a tornado of branches breaking and all kinds of stuff. And so at that point, the bear is to my right, the elk that I thought I had just shot again is kind of going straight away from me. And I just turned around and just backed out from both of those two directions, just got space between me and all the action.
Yeah.
Wow.
So he came at you, you shot once. Could you have shot another time as he was kind of paralleling you, but you kind of decided at that point he was exiting the scene?
Yeah, exactly. I shot once, and I think that I hit him, and I think that I probably hit him in his rear end somewhere from, like his shoulders back, because the angle that I was holding my arm was pointing down. So, he was like at my feet. I think I probably hit him, if I did hit him, in his back somewhere. And like I said, the recoil pulse, and I reacquired my sights on him as he was turning and exiting. And, it all happened, the whole incident happened probably 2 seconds, I would guess.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Not much time there. I think myself, just in that scenario, if I had another shot at him, I don't know if I would have been able to hold off the trigger like you did. I think I might have just kept firing until I didn't see that bear anymore, but I have no idea.
Right.
That's
yeah.
just wild.
Yeah, exactly. That thought didn't enter my mind, I don't think. You know, once I saw him going away from me, you know, I only saw him for probably less than 2 seconds. You know, a draw stroke takes a second. So, you know, I only had another second to get off 2 shots. Once he was going away from me and I started exiting the scene, I just backed out into a big clearing, topped off my gun, and then just exited the valley.
Man, what was going through your head at that point? I mean, I imagine there's got to be this a huge rush of adrenaline and that. But I mean, were you rattled? Were you freaking shaking? Like, what did that look like?
Yeah, it's funny. So at that point, I'd been searching for an elk for, 3 days or 4 days or something like that. And so, you know, I had just found that elk. I thought I had shot him again. You know, I thought I'd gotten another arrow into him again. And so I was just utterly elated that I had found this elk that I thought I had lost.
Yeah.
You know, and it just so happened that there was also a bear there, and you know, like he kind of won my elk too, and now he's gone again. And so I was still just fully concentrating on this elk, and I do carry a Garmin inReach, a satellite messenger, and so I sent out a message to my brother, asking for help to come pack this bull out. And I said that, you know, I'd had a bear encounter and that, asking him to bring another buddy and to come up and we'll all three go in and get this elk, 'cause I'm sure I just got him, you know?
Yeah.
And so I back out that right after the encounter and go and pretty much, well, let's see here. No, yeah, I drove all the way back out and called in the encounter at that point.
To the wildlife department.
To FWP.
Yeah.
Yep, to the Fish and Wildlife. And they were pretty snappy about it. They got a warden over there, and I met with the warden that night, and gave them, they wanted to hear my story, basically. And then, you know, I told them everything. I just told you guys. And then he said that they would investigate it and get back in touch with me with any questions. And at that point I told him, I'm sure I've got a dead elk laying in there now. So we're going to go back in there tomorrow to get this elk, which they weren't excited about, but at the same time, he kind of got where I was coming from.
Yeah.
And so he, you know, wanted me to call him when we got back out and, you know, let him know if we found a bear in there also, or, you know, whatever. And so, at that point, my brother and another good friend, come up the next morning and we all three go in there this time and go back to pretty much the same scene and we're looking for blood and looking for the elk tracks and stuff and looking for my arrow and finally find my arrow and it was totally clean. I apparently shot under the bull.
Oh no.
So at that point it just all comes like crashing down on me, you know, like all this stuff I just went through.
Yeah.
And I still don't have this freaking elk. So, at that point, it was early in the morning still, all three of us, kind of broke up and grid searched the direction that I thought that elk was going. We never even really went up the valley, which is the direction the bear went. You know, we are obviously very aware of what just happened. So we were doing what we could to avoid going where I thought that bear was at, even though I thought there was a dead elk in there. You know, we were fully expecting to go in there and find a dead elk with a bear on it. At which point we would have backed out of and, you know, marked it and backed out of and receded our rights to the elk.
But yeah.
I just had to keep looking.
Yeah. Yeah. 100%. So it seems like that bear was also trailing that elk. Is that kind of what you were under the notion, or do you think it was kind of caught off guard as well? Or
yeah. Yep. So, you know, like I said, as it was happening, I registered it as, you know, I bumped this elk out of his bed and he's too sick to run. I think, you know, now looking back at it, I think what happened was that elk and that bear were, you know, kind of having a standoff in that group of timber that I just happened to wander right in between the two of them. And that elk knew that bear was there, and that's probably why he didn't run. He, you know, didn't want to turn and run away from that bear and have that bear chase him. Until I took off running after that elk that bear saw my excited movement and, you know, his predator senses kicked in and said, here's something to chase, you know,
and came
after me.
That's so, wild.
You know, I'm sure that it just sucks to say, but I know I got hit that elk. I'm sure that elk died in the next couple of nights. And I'm sure that bear could, you know, smell it or sense it or whatever, and was either just trailing that elk or was maybe trying to, you know, make a kill and finish him off. But I think that's certainly the reason that bear was in that area.
Yeah, yeah, 100%. Now, do you have, like, what's your perspective on grizzly bears now that you've had this, I mean, very close encounter? Thank God, you know, you didn't end up getting mauled or, you know, physically harmed. But, like, do you have a different perspective or a different appreciation for them now that you've had that, you know, charge and you've been in that really crazy scenario?
Right. I'm not allowed to really think about this because I don't think I do have any different outlook on them. You know, again, going back to what I'd said previously, it was a series of mistakes leading up to a bad encounter. And so, you know, I mean, I was well aware of the mistakes I was making, you know, going in there by myself, you know, hunting quietly through the timber, not making noise, all this stuff. You know, I was aware that I was putting myself in the worst possible situation that you can put yourself in. And so for the encounter to come out as it did, you know, it sucks to say, but it's like almost expected. I could see that my outlook would be much different if I just happened to have that encounter, you know, hiking down the trail, or if a bear came into my camp or something.
Yeah.
I could see it being different, but no, I mean, I would like to say that I'll do things differently next time. You know, if I'm trailing a hit bull, it's a darn good idea to have a partner in there with you, you know?
Yeah.
Just for this, I mean, for the tracking also, but obviously for, you know, an encounter like this. You know, I'm happy to see bears on the landscape. I'm happy that we have large predators on the landscape. I would like to see, you know, I'd like to see more habitat and more game on that habitat. So, I think they say that, you know, grizzly bears have around 4% of their native range or something like that. if we could have that be on 100% of the range, then, you know, they'd be here in Billings, Montana, and out in Miles City and everything.
Yeah.
Obviously, we can't have that kind of a population. But, no, I think I'm happy that they're out there. I think it's good for the soul to have that primordial fear of a superior being, of a superior animal out there. You know, it's good to keep your ego in check.
Yeah.
If you will.
Not the top of the food chain in that scenario, that's for sure.
Yeah, exactly. We have guns and everything, automobiles and all that stuff, but when it's just you and a bear out there, you're not at the top of the food chain anymore.
For sure. Now, what did the Fish and Game say about this incident? Did they ever get back to you with anything?
Yeah. So, you know, so after all that occurred, we went back out and I called them again. And, you know, we never found any bear blood. I mean, we didn't really track him or anything, but we didn't find any bear blood. Obviously didn't find a bear carcass laying there. So we told them that, and they, you know, they said that they were going to go in and do a pack trip into this area to look around and, you know, just check up on my story. And, I mean, they were super easy to work with. They went in and did that. And I think I asked the guy to, you know, like, look for my bull. Let me know if you find a bull back there. And I think he called me back afterwards and, you know, told me about their trip in there and said he never, you know, they never found a bear or anything either. And then they, you know, they said that it sounds like, you know, my encounter was a legitimate act of self-defense and that was cut and dry and not to, you know, expect anything more from them. So, they were very pleasant to deal with. Like I said, I came out of the mountains and called them and it was pretty late at night. I think by the time I got out and called them and they were quick to act. They had a warden that was driving down the highway, I think, it just happened to be somewhat close to me, and he turned around and came back and interviewed me.
Yeah.
But, yeah, they were totally fine to deal with and happy to help me out and everything. So,
yeah. Yeah. That's good to hear. It's got my mind kind of racing. I was like, man, I need to interview one of those officers that, you know, has gone in and did a lot of these grizzly investigations. I think that'd be really neat to hear all their stories.
It would be interesting to hear from them because, you know, I kind of chatted with them, and this happened the weekend that over in Ennis, I think there were 3 bear attacks in like the same weekend in the same drainage. And this happened the same weekend as those 3 attacks. And so, you know, he was kind of telling me about those attacks and so, yeah, I'm sure they get a lot of reports. It'd be interesting to hear their perspective on it.
Yeah. 100%. And, you know, I obviously I don't live in that area and I don't really know anything about grizzly bears and, you know, their populations, but gosh, I would have to think at some point, you know, there would have to be some consideration for grizzly bear hunting in the lower 48. I think it's been on the docket before, but it's been always pushed down. But gosh, it just seems like these incidents are occurring, or maybe we're just hearing about them more because of news and how stuff spreads through social media and whatnot, but maybe it has something to do with that. But it seems like at some point there might have to be some sort of hunting season, you know, in regards to grizzly bears. Like, what's your take on that? Would you be for that? Would you be against it? No opinion?
Sure. yeah. I mean, currently there's still are back on the Endangered Species Act, you know. They've been removed twice, and then through litigation they've been put back on twice again. And so currently, you know, we're not for the immediate future, we're not going to be hunting them anytime soon.
Yeah.
I think the, you know, the current argument against it is this idea that, you know, we have island populations of bears that are thriving, that are above objective. But, you know, some people are worried that these island populations need to be interconnected to share genetic, you know, to ensure genetic viability. And so, you know, we have these pockets of bears that are over objective to, you know, to
carrying
satisfy
capacity.
The ESA requirements. And it would sure be nice if we could remove ESA protection from portions of the grizzly bear population and still leave other portions that haven't recovered protected, you know?
Yeah.
So, yeah, I would like to see them removed off the ESA. And then at that point, I think there is a sustainable enough population that we could begin to hunt them. I think at the levels of take that we would be allowed, you know, I think it's only going to look like maybe a couple of bears a year.
Yeah, yeah.
So, you know, I'm all for that, 100%. So hopefully we'll see it in the next 10 years. That's definitely something that I think we all need to be paying attention to.
Yeah, yeah, for sure. Obviously, grizzly bears by nature are very, you know, can be very aggressive and, you know, they're at the top of the food chain, but you can't help but wonder, you know, if these attacks keep happening more often, that maybe they might be just building some association with, I mean, humans are not a threat because they're not getting hunted, or they're only getting shot at unless they're, you know, attacking or in pursuit of something like that. So you just wonder if we're kind of setting ourselves up for more of these to happen because of there's not any sort of hunting taking place currently on grizzlies.
Right. Yeah. 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 That's certainly a question worth pondering. And I don't know with, you know, if we're only going to be able to hunt, you know, one or two bears a year, how long it would take to reinstill this.
Yeah.
You know,
is it going to do anything? Yeah. You never know.
Yeah. Is it going to do anything? Especially when already the incidents that we're having are largely when, you know, you're stumbling onto a kill site or you're scaring the bear, you know, startling the bear. I think, you know, with my past experiences, you know, if the bear knows you're coming, you know, I've seen them on trails and made noise and stuff, and they've turned and left. You know, they already have a innate fear or just want to avoid humans. It's just when we're, you know, either threatening their food source or just too dang close and startling them that we're having these negative encounters. So it'd be interesting to see if killing some of them would lower those negative encounters or not.
Yeah. Yeah. Interesting stuff. Well, Mike, this has been really cool. I've really enjoyed this. I've learned a lot from, you know, just grizzly bear country, elk hunting in general, to, you know, what not to do, what to do, and then also just, you know, being with you there while, you know, you're telling the story. It feels like I was out there with you. It was just really cool to hear that. And, you know, interesting to say the least. I really enjoyed that. I appreciate you coming on.
Yeah, good. It's been fun. I appreciate the opportunity.
Yeah, we'll have to have you back on at some point. You know, it sounds like you're a very well seasoned hunter in the elk woods. Might have to get you back on for an episode to give us some tips and some, you know, further hunting stories. That'd be great.
Yeah, absolutely. That sounds like a good time. You'll have to let me know if you ever make it up to Montana here.
For sure. Yeah, I definitely will. Like I said, it's on the docket here in the next year or so to start hunting Idaho, Montana, trying some different places. I do want to hunt in grizzly country. I think that would be really cool and cut my teeth there. So I'm sure once I kind of get things lined up, I'll definitely be reaching out to you for some pointers and some, you know, some preparation for that hunt.
Yeah, you bet. Well, cool. Happy to help out.
Yeah, well, great. I appreciate it. Well, we'll talk to you soon. Thanks again, and you have a great evening, Mike.
All right. Thanks a lot.
All right, and there it is, another episode in the books. Big thanks to Mike for coming on the show. Had a blast, really enjoyed that, and learned a lot. You know, I will be hunting Idaho or Montana, you know, within the next couple years. So this has got me really excited to do that. And, you know, grizzly bear hunting, it's not grizzly bear hunting, but hunting elk in grizzly country is just something that's kind of magical, or I guess you kind of become more drawn to something that has a level of danger to it, right? So then, and that's kind of where I'm at. So I just thought that was really cool. Really enjoyed the story, man. That's got to be really scary to have an animal like that come charging at you with really no time to react. And sounds like Mike handled it about as best as he could. So that was just really wild, and hope you guys enjoyed that too. If you are planning on hunting elk in Colorado, you've yet to do it, definitely go to transitionwild.com, subscribe, and get the Colorado Beginner Elk Hunting Guide. It's going to walk you through everything from scouting to gear to resources on, you know, tags and draw odds and all that stuff. So go subscribe, transitionwild.com. I'll send you the Colorado Beginner Elk Hunting Guide for free. Make sure you're leaving those 5-star reviews, whether you're listening on iTunes, Stitcher, Podbean, Google Play, Spotify. I mean, we're everywhere now on the Sportsman's Nation Network. So make sure any platform you're listening to, subscribe, leave those reviews. It really does mean a lot, and I really appreciate that. All right, thanks again to our sponsors, Expedition Archery, Skull Brew Coffee, and Outdoor Edge Knives. Thanks again for tuning in, and we'll talk to you soon.